When you hear the word you in a song, it pulls you in very intimately. The second thing I learned was managing people was harder than it looked. You can love radio, but it doesn't love you back.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we hear from those who made a difference. Valerie Geller.
Once upon a time, in the far-off land of Los Angeles, California, I was born and raised. When I was about 6 or 7 years old, I was a night baby. I was a nocturnal animal, and I grew up in a household of people who slept through the night, and I discovered a transistor radio. So when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, I used to listen at night under my pillow, very quietly, to the radio, and that magical world of stories and people and music and news and events and deep interviews. And it was bringing in lots of worlds and experiences I'd never heard before.
This is indeed an historic day, the only time a president has ever resigned from office in our nearly 200 years of history.
It was during a time when journalism was really changing the world. I mean, we had Woodward and Bernstein take down President Nixon. There was a war going on in Vietnam. There were lots of different things going on. Women's rights were in question. Rights of all human beings were in question. There was a lot going on in the world that was wrong. And it became very clear to me, even in high school, that one person could make a difference, and that information was power, and that if you got information to people, they could make choices and decisions about their lives that would empower them and could ultimately change a culture and change a society, and that truth, real stories, real information was quite powerful, and I wanted to be a part of it.
Seated opposite me is an attractive young woman. She looks like a normal American girl who might live just down the street and who possibly grew up with your kids and mine. But Joan Palmer has been a prostitute since she was 16 years old. Whose fault was it? Who takes the rap for the fact that 16-year-old kids learn to sell their bodies?
And there was a guy in Los Angeles I used to listen to. He was called Joe Pine, and he did a nighttime show. And one night on his program, and it had talkback, and on his program, he did a topic about how children should be seen and not heard, and you should never take them to a restaurant because they make too much noise and they disrupt and disturb the other diners. Well, I was little, and I heard that, and he was wrong, and I called the show. And I remember walking down the hall in my fuzzy pink slippers and, you know, picking up the telephone, and it was a rotary dial, and being put on hold and getting through on the air. And I said, now look, when you're little, you're told when to go to bed, who to play with, when to go to school, what to wear, church. Everything in your life is determined for you. The only thing we can do as kids is make noise. So please just leave us alone and let us make the noise we need to make. And he said, kid, you can call my show anytime. So I became like a little kid caller on the Joe Pine show. And to this day, I run into people, you know, it's been many, many decades since Joe Pine was active. And I run into people now who say, you were that kid on the Joe Pine show. And it was interesting because that's really where my love of radio and my understanding of what it could be and what it could mean and how personal it was. I felt personally affronted by something I heard on the radio. And that's when I learned the personal is universal. And I was a radio lover from that moment on. The bug had bitten.
News and conversation station, KABC Radio 79 in Los Angeles.
Time for weekend news from ABC Radio.
At first I thought it would be law. You know, work within the system, work with the laws, try to help make the laws more fair for people. And I was very interested in law. We had a lot of lawyers in the family, and I sort of grew up around the table talking about different, you know, nuance of law. But I didn't know any happy lawyers. The lawyers I knew were not happy doing the job. They did important work, they did necessary work, but I didn't know any joyful lawyers. And I had a cousin who was a journalist. His name was Irwin Baker, and he was serving in the Los Angeles Times. He covered the city desk. He was at the LA Examiner. And he was my one cousin who really followed his heart and was successful as a journalist. And so I watched him and learned from him and understood there was a whole career out there that I could do. I ended up, when I was at university, I was leaning toward print journalism and had started writing and had worked a lot as a freelance journalist and sold pieces to various newspapers and magazines. And I had done an article about logging. Louisiana Pacific was one of the lumber companies. They were cutting down trees and not reforesting. And there were four or five generations of lumber logging families up in the area, and that was their livelihood. We also had the Sierra Club, and they were interested in putting the trees back. So I did two stories. I went and lived with a fourth generation family for a week and did their story in the logging industry, and then I followed around the Sierra Club environmentalist guy for a week. Did two stories side by side, was asked to come into the radio station and talk about the stories. So I walked into a radio station, and instantly I felt like I had walked onto my planet. It just felt like home to me walking into a radio station. There was music. People were alive. People were dancing in the hallways. Everybody was interested in everything. Chewing gum under the seats, you know, that chair where the one wheel doesn't touch the ground. Posters all over for every single rock band that's ever been, you know, developed since the beginning of time. There's a certain kind of a smell of burned coffee pot where the coffee has bubbled into the machine overnight and burned, and old cigarettes, and that's what it smelled like. No windows anywhere in a basement. The walls covered with black sponge to insulate, and none of it matched, and there were big gaps and holes in between the sponge. And then there had been a fire, so the remnants of the burnout of the fire were still there, and no two chairs matched, no desks matched. And I remember having to literally break up a fight over a chair between two guys, because when one was on the radio, the other would take the good chair, the one where all four wheels touched the ground. And then the other one would grab the chair when the other guy was on the air. So it erupted into a fist fight at one point, and then we got out the catalog and ordered the man a new chair, and that seemed to solve the problem. And that's when I realized maybe, you know, management wasn't so terrible if you could find solutions. I went on the talkback show and talked about my article, and they called me Monday and said, would you like to come back and have a show? And I went, absolutely, and I didn't look back. It was a multi-format. It was a public radio station, and it was not unlike a lot of stations here where, you know, the music show was in the morning, and then there'd be a talkback show in the afternoon, a little bit of public affairs, a lot of calendar of what's happening in the town, and that would be amassed. Live performances, you know, if things were going on. But, you know, professors or people who'd written books coming in and talking, and then lots and lots of interaction with the audience. I did a bunch of different shows, and mostly it was a talkback show. And it was student-y radio, so it was very low-key and very loose. And I really didn't get into professional talkback radio until I had gone back to Los Angeles, worked as a producer, and then went to a city in the middle of America called Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I worked there, and that's where I had a talk show, where I self-produced it, so I really got to do every job. What I understood in moving to 13 cities early in my career, doing journalism, talk radio, producing, ultimately news director and executive producer, what I learned was that you are always a child in the home of your parents. If you start at a radio station as a news reporter, they're never going to really see you as anything but a news reporter. So you actually have to leave that station and sometimes leave the city to be a news director or to be an executive producer or to be a talkback host. So I moved to very many cities, and I lived in Denver, Tampa, Phoenix, Grand Rapids, Michigan, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and ultimately New York.
101.3 K101 Family Fiasco. Listen, you haven't seen any fiasco like this one. It's Sibling Rivalry. It's a great new comedy with Kirstie Alley, you know, Rebecca on Cheers, and only K101 has your tickets. You can pick up.
I had been working in Phoenix, Arizona, for the Pulitzer family, who give out the Pulitzer Prizes and own the St. Louis Post and Dispatch, and they're a very famous journalism company in America. And the Pulitzer Prize is certainly a very coveted honor and award. And I had the opportunity to work in news and a little bit of talkback work for a company that valued it. If you wanted to go cover the copper strike in South America, you got a plane ticket and a backpack and off you went. If you wanted to cover, you know, a war in the Middle East, you just told them where you wanted to go and you would have carte blanche. And some of the most talented people I've ever worked with came out of that situation. One of the people I worked with is now doing the breakfast show on 1010 Winds in New York, and he's one of the most listened to talents in America and in the world. Another person was the top number one voiceover man, Charlie Van Dyke, in America.
Hi, and welcome to American Top 40. My name's Charlie Van Dyke, and I'm all set with the latest Billboard survey of record sales and radio airplay from coast to coast.
Number 40.
Leading off is the latest hit by Culture Club, the first ballad they've
so
released.
So it was just a very rarefied air of journalism and true-hearted journalists, of people who really understood. You could get the bad guys and you could change the world if you put out truth. And you could also put a spotlight on things that were being done right so people knew about it. And so it was sort of filled with that I took on the news director job in San Francisco from about, I would say, 83, 84 till about 88, 89, and had a marvelous staff of people who are all, again, went on to do incredible things. And it was creative, and it was San Francisco, and it was a lot of fun. And we did five-minute news inside of a music radio format. So the top and the bottom of the hour, we did 5 minutes of news, and we won lots of awards, and I was really proud of my staff.
K101, and I hoid it through the grapevines. Chris Edwards, playing what you're saying. How about instant request? Bev, take a break, okay? I'll get 478-K101 and get a song on the air now.
And during the job interview, they said, have you ever done a budget? And I, whatever. You know, how hard could it be, really? And it was my first time doing a budget all by myself. So I was sitting in a meeting. They handed us the budgets from last year. And I looked at it, and it was like reading Greek. I didn't understand one line of what these things were. And I felt like I was really in over my head. So I did what you do, which is I called up my accountant and said, Peter, can I come over with my budget? And he said, sure. And Peter Ling spent 3 hours with me going over my budget, and I learned how to do a budget from my very own personal accountant. I remember the director asked me, I have a question about line number 17 here. And I'm like, I'll have that information for you tomorrow. And I got up and ran out of the room. You know, Peter, what's line number 17? Okay, accruing equipment costs, okay. But I learned how to do it that way. And so that to me was the first Mount Everest when I started my job. The second thing I learned was managing people was harder than it looked. One of the curses of radio is that everyone can talk, so everyone thinks it's easy. And one of the curses of management is that everybody's had a bad boss, everybody's had a good boss, but not everybody's been a boss. And the hardest thing about being a manager is that you are no longer friends with people you used to be friends with when you came up, because the roles have changed. And you cannot be friends with them because the playing field is not level and you have power over their lives. So no matter what you think and no matter how smart you are, when you go from being a person who is sort of boots on the ground to being a leader or a manager, the role is going to change and people are going to change how they deal with you. And people you've been deeply friendly with your whole life, the relationships change. And that was something that I found challenging. K101 was a music radio station, primarily music, but they did a lot of news and public affairs and had a very deep news and public affairs commitment. So at the height of it, we had 11 or 12 people, including our part-timers, on staff. And then we had a public affairs show that we did, talkback show. And it was a pretty hefty commitment to news and public affairs because San Francisco and the Bay Area, really, people demanded it. So even though the city supported a public talk radio station and they supported two news and talk stations, they also really wanted news and information from the music stations as well.
In Washington, Jamie Dupree, KFI News.
And the news brought to you by the Southern California Chrysler dealers, KFI News Time 704. Sports now, here's Rich Murata.
Well, one of the most thrilling days in
I'm very proud that when I was on KFI, I won the LA Press Club Best Newscast Award with my on-air partner, Dan Avey, for that newscast coverage covering a breaking news fire in Los Angeles, and I was sitting in that day, and Dan was sitting in that day, and we really hadn't worked together that much, but in a crisis we came together, and lo and behold, that was the day that got submitted for the award, and we won the LA Press Club Best Newscast Award for a major market radio station. That was a surprise to me. And it's always surprising to me because when you do radio, you don't know who's listening. You don't know. And the most important thing I learned then, and it's still true today, if you talk to one person on the air at all times, it will work. If you use the word you instead of we, me, I, us, or our, it will work. When you listen to music and you feel that the singer is singing to you personally, and you feel you know the singer, often the word you is in the song. Bob Dylan, you've got a lot to lose to say, you know, you got a lot of nerve to say you are my friend. You and I travel to the beat of a different drum.
You and I travel to the beat of a different drum.
You hear the word you in a song, it pulls you in very intimately. And when you hear the word I, you still can connect to the story. It's somebody's experience, but it never opens the door to your heart and your psyche the way the word you does. We're very lucky in the English language. I work in a lot of languages other than English. I work in 36, 38 countries, and many, many languages I work in with radio shows and podcasts now do not have the luxury that we have in English. Because in English, the word you means the group and the individual. And that's a gift in our language.
Yes, and I ain't saying you ain't pretty. Oh, I'm saying
I was never as happy with my work as I was finding and developing people and helping them get better. And I realized some people are actors and others are directors and some are both. And I could do both, but I was happiest directing rather than acting. The day that I found being a reporter was no longer for me was a day that I covered an airplane crash where small children had died, and they were laying out the bodies in body bags and identifying the people who had died, and the parents of the children were arriving, and some were there. Some had died, others were injured and screaming for their kids. And I remember looking down and seeing a small yellow body bag with a little foot with a patent leather shoe and a lacy sock sticking out of it of a dead child. And I absolutely wept and lost it, and I felt that I could not do this anymore. I had nightmares for weeks, and I felt broken inside from that. And that was the day I thought I didn't want to do the news anymore. I couldn't be a reporter anymore and do this covering car crashes and fires and devastation and corrupt politicians. I was getting very disillusioned, and yet I knew these stories were important to be told, but I felt perhaps it would be better for other people to tell them rather than me. So after K101, I had heard, after I'd been there for quite a few years, and was actually getting itchy. You know, I felt like I'd really done everything I could do there. Our staff was fantastic. We'd had a wall full of awards. I had served on the Northern California Radio and Television News Directors Board. I'd served locally on the Emergency Earthquake Preparedness Board for the City of San Francisco in my job. And I'd done a lot of things that really were community service. And I was getting a little itchy. And I was missing talkback radio. And I heard that in Los Angeles, a radio station called KFI was about to change format from music to talk. And I nosed around and made some calls, and I ended up getting a job in 1988 as executive producer of the brand new talkback station. 2 years later, when it went from number 28 to top 5 in Los Angeles, I was then invited to become the program director of WABC Talkback Radio in New York. And I took that job and didn't look back. You know, it was an iconic station in New York, but I was not from New York. So I think I had a different view of it, which was good, because I didn't see it as the great hallowed hall of walking WABC. I wasn't afraid to make changes or put people in that I thought were good. I understood it as a big radio station, not as a religion or a thing that, you know, an iconic entity. because I hadn't grown up listening to it. And I think in a lot of ways that helped me, whereas a lot of people who had been in there were very afraid to touch things in there because they had remembered it from their childhoods and they didn't want to mess with something. But when things no longer work, sometimes change can be a very good thing. And so to work with WABC, to put in strong personalities, to take over the mantle from a very talented program director who had come before me, to put in people in America. We hired Joy Behar, who became very well known in America, a stand-up comedian and a former teacher.
I used to teach English to high school dropouts in one of the toughest neighborhoods in New York, the kind of kids who go to jail because they set fire to their parents. Then they'd send them to me to teach them the difference between who and whom. That was the job.
We hired a guy who had been, he started as a caller on shows, you know, on talkback shows. He was a funny caller. And then he came in as a producer of one of our shows. And he did a lot of imitations and a lot of voices. He could imitate Frank Sinatra and make up songs. And I mean, he just had a marvelous ear, just like a brilliant actor ear and very, very funny guy. And his name was Jay Diamond. And we put him on the air. And that's how we found him. There was a guy, Lionel, who, when I worked in Tampa, Florida, had been a caller to my show. Well, he was in law school, very funny guy, and he ended up with a show on WABC. I would go to comedy clubs and hear comedians, although they don't necessarily make the best talkback hosts because comedians sometimes don't listen. They just listen enough so that they can say the next funny thing, but they don't really hear what people are telling them. And part of the criteria for hiring a talkback host is hiring people who listen deeply. They hear not just the words, but really what people are telling them. Deep listening is a gift, and you really need those people. I always hire people that can answer the question, would you take a five-hour car journey with this person and have a great time? Could you go from the equally substantive to frivolous topics, you know, talk about politics or war or death and destruction, and then burst into song or play the license plate game? You know, you can full range human. And if you can find people who can be full range human beings on the air and who have something to say, who are great listeners, you know, who are people who love stories and who are good storytellers and people who have a motor inside them, the party starts when they walk in the room. Those are the kinds of people you want to put on the air. They'll get, keep, and grow audiences for you. Here's what you can tell in any language with any talent. If they care about what they're talking about, if they have passion, if they have genuine interest or curiosity, or if they're just reading questions off a page, if they are reading in any language, you can hear it. It's very palpable. If they're talking and communicating, natural curiosity has a different sound to it than root questions. Okay? Live radio sounds different than produced radio. So these are things in every culture that you can tell. And voices are intimate. You know, it's in radio is intimate. So it's a very personal medium. Actors don't do well in personality radio. It's not an acting gig. They do really well in scripted stories, and they do really well reading commercials and adverts. But when it's one person just talking to another in the middle of the night on the radio, actors don't do as well as real, true personalities.
Good evening. The deadline has come and gone. The Iraqis are living on what President Bush calls borrowed time. It is no longer whether the war will start, but when.
We had a couple of really fantastic hosts and a news department that I was very, very proud of. And when we went into the Gulf War, I was given a mandate that we had to cut. And it was heading into a huge news event, and I knew we were going to need reporters, not cut reporters. We were News Talk in New York, and if they cut my news department from 12 people down to 4 people, I knew we would lose in the ratings. And if we would lose in the ratings, then it would be my head on a plate, and I would be the sacrificial lamb. So I basically said, I will not sack these people. It's wrong to do it. What will happen is people will go elsewhere to find the news because we are going to war. And we need to have people covering this, or we will lose. And so I left the job over that because I would not cut my staff, and I didn't want to. And I didn't want to lose, and I also wanted to do what was right. So they brought in somebody else who, of course, cut the news department. The news department, we lost ratings, and that person ultimately left. So, again, everything I sort of foresaw came to be. WABC, New York. Everything I learned was trial and error. Everything I know, I learned from failing first. Failing first and having my whole life depend on getting, keeping, growing audiences and getting ratings. And as a woman coming up in the 1970s and 80s, the doors were not exactly wide open. So just like when you would go to a female doctor or a lawyer during those days, they just had to be better. They had fought battles, and you were proven on your merit. Developing the model, generator reactor, that was what worked. Generator reactor actually came in a dream. I was really looking for a way to talk about talent dynamics. How do you find your best self? How do you put yourself into power as an on-air personality? And some people very clearly were great on the air alone in a room. Other people were great off air, but the minute you put a microphone in front of them, they would become very stiff and not good at all, and they would become a different person. It became very clear to me that as soon as somebody would walk in the room and they could have a conversation, the news guy, the calls would start with talk back. As soon as they were talking to another person, their creativity would get stimulated and they would kick back in and they would get their color back. And I wanted to find words to talk about the difference in dynamic between those people who seemed to be self-starters and the ones who really needed to talk to other people to come alive and have their talent show. And I went to bed one night and I just thought, I wish I could just come up with terms for this. It's not alpha and beta. It's not impact player and the B player. It's not the sidekick. It's about the essence of your talent. How do you come to fire? How do you become your best self? And I woke up at 3 in the morning and the words generator reactor were in my head from a dream. And I wrote it down on a piece of paper and I went back to sleep. And the next morning I went, okay, that's it. Before I had left WABC, I started thinking, what do I really want to do? And after programming in New York City, in America, it's the number one market, and it seemed like everything else might be a letdown. What did I really want to do? And it turned out, when I made the list of what I enjoyed doing, it was finding and developing talent and working one-on-one with programs to help each program get to strength, get to power. And I had good ears, and I was pretty good at finding and developing talent. Those were the things that I had learned how to do, and I was good at it. So I thought, how can I do this in a way where I can earn a living and get paid and get to do what I like? So what happened was I wrote letters. I went through every single city and found large signal radio stations that had the talkback format that were underperforming. So they had big signals, and they had no listeners. And I understood that there were three reasons those stations were not getting listeners. Number one, they were boring. Number two, they weren't relevant to the audience. And number three, they might be depressing. And so people were tuning out. So if we could fix those things by developing compelling personalities, making it a mix of fun and serious issues, and making it companion listening in such a way that people feel like, I don't want to go through my day without tuning into this radio station. And I had worked with and helped develop a lot of radio stations that were hugely successful and very compelling. And I wanted to see if I could do that in other markets across the country. So I wrote letters to six radio stations that were shamefully underrated. Shameful. And I offered my services. I said, look, why don't you do this? I'll come in for a week. I won't charge you anything. I'll come in for free. I will buy my own plane ticket, and you can put me up at Motel 6, which was like our worst motel. You can put me up anywhere. And for a week, let me work with your radio station. And if you like what I do, then I will ask you to hire me on a one-year contract. And out of the six letters, five people flew me in. And out of those five, four hired me, and that was the money I needed to stay in New York. And after a year, every single one of those radio stations, one doubled in ratings, one had a 30% increase, and one had doubled their revenue and had a 15% increase in their ratings. So at the end of a year, I had a story to tell as somebody who was a show fixer, a station fixer, and someone who could find and develop talent outside of the radio stations I had worked with directly. So I had a track record now. And I wrote some articles because I had developed a model to train talkback hosts. And I'd written an article about it. And I was asked to speak at the Medien Forum in Cologne, Germany, and talk about this model. And the Germans are crazy about models. If you give them a model, they're so happy. They just love structure and models. The more structure and the more models you can give them, the happier the broadcasters in Germany are. So I had developed three or four models. They all were 100% effective if you do them. As effective as water the grass will grow. The models were that effective. And it started with tell the truth, make it matter, never be boring. And the next thing was, when you do a show, focus. What do you want to talk about? What are the three or four topics that audiences are always interested in? And then you really could break it down. Straight out of Frank Maggot and Associates, the research company, Health, Heart, Pocketbook. Health and safety, money and politics, emotion, any topic that would touch the heart of the audience. And finally, the fourth one, which really came in around the time of Oprah Winfrey's popularity, and that was transformational topics. How your life can be better tomorrow than it is today because of something that you're hearing on the radio. So finding focus was the first part of the model. Engage. What's in it for a listener? And this is where the you comes in. What's in it for the audience? Nothing should go on the air unless you can answer the question, why should I listen to this? Or here's why you need to listen. Whatever you say next should be the opening of your whatever you're going to say. So what's your engage point? So think about that. And then what do you think about the thing you're talking about? If you do news, I never want to know your opinion position. But if you haven't thought about it enough to have formed one, you don't care. And if you don't care, how are you going to make the audience care? Now you're just an actor playing the part. You're not telling the truth. You're faking. So when in doubt, leave it out. Somebody else will cover it. Talk about things you're interested in. Going on the premise that most journalists and most talk personalities and most producers are interested in most everything, because there are no boring stories, only boring storytellers. And the last part of the model after focus, engage, opinion, position was storytelling. Can you tell a story? And if you can tell a story, how could you even tell it better? And in fact, storytelling is such a core key part of the work that we do. I'll never hire somebody if they can't tell me a story or a joke three different times, three different ways. If you can't sit in my office and make it interesting three times, how are you going to do that on the air? And so there's that skill. So all of those things are part of the model that I developed. And I talked about this in Cologne, Germany. In the back of the room were two people from Sveriges Radio, Swedish radio in Sweden. And it was 1993-94, and they were just about ready to get commercial radio in Sweden. And the Swedes said, we would like to bring you into Sweden to tell everybody in public radio what to expect from commercial radio and how we can strengthen ourselves so that we can become even better to fight the onslaught of this new choice that the audience is going to have. And it was an adventure, and it was as different from New York as night from day. Literally, it was mostly night, mostly dark in the winter. And after Sweden, and it was successful, I went to work in Finland and Norway and Denmark. And after that, I started working a lot in Australia and with the ABC, and had a 10-year experience consulting and training presenters at the ABC. And then worked with CBC in Canada, and it just went on from there.
From coast to coast, this is CBC Radio.
The thing that's different is the attention span of the audience. In Europe, there's a longer attention span than there is in the United States. In Africa, many of the native languages, because Africa has a history of oral storytelling and oral language, every word in Swahili is a picture. So sometimes working in Africa, it's even easier with some of the languages to create word pictures and to make experiences for the audience. The music is different in countries. the topics that are of interest to human beings are the same everywhere. So these things are not radio or American or British or Canadian or Australian or French. It's being human. And the more courage you have as a creative person to go deep and tell your truth, the better a broadcaster you're going to be. Because I freelance, I have to work with horses that are going to be champions and win the race. Because if your horse doesn't win the race today, I don't work next year. If what I do doesn't increase your audience, I will not be hired by anybody in a year. And I've been working in this business for 38 years, and I hope to God I can go on until the day I drop. One of my best friends growing up was from England, and the Corder family was my introduction to the British way of life. Tea is sacred. Tea must be boiled. You know, things Americans didn't normally know about English people and English culture and the English way of life. I was always amazed at the cutting, mean remarks that could be made at a dinner table with a smile on the face and the politeness, that the snark level could be so high and yet it was so civilized. I was blown out. The art of British conversation is amazing, and it is an art, and when done correctly, there's nothing like it. So to work in this country with talk radio, where the art of conversation is absolutely top flight, you're going to hear things on air you will not hear anywhere else on the planet. And it was very, very exciting. I first came in to the UK doing workshops and seminars. And through a friend in Sweden who does audience research, my name was given to the then managing director of LBC. And he and I met for coffee, and I basically laid out a plan for how to start a talkback radio station that could be successful. And I said, look, it takes 3 years. It takes twice the money you think it's going to take. And don't promote early. Don't put your big stars on buses and billboards, because in 3 months, half of them are going to be gone. Everybody in the world has three talk shows in them, but it's the fourth that's the killer. And the curse of our business is that everyone can talk, so everyone thinks this is easy. But it is not easy. Just like a great football player or a great ballet dancer, the great ones make it look easy. And all you have to do is sit in that chair and try it for a week, and you'll know that it takes skill, training, true talent, and lots of time in the seat of just getting better. So it takes 3 years to develop a talkback radio station. And if you don't have 3 years of commitment, money-wise and contract-wise, you will not be successful. You will lose money and not see any success for 3 years. And of course, nobody wants to hear that. You don't want to hear that it's going to take a very long time. Everybody wants to think they'll put a bunch of stars on, hire big name people, and it'll work. And the reality is, yes, big stars and giving away a lot of money works for the day that you have the star on and you have the money given away. But the next day, if you don't have a relationship with the audience and you're not making it relevant and talking deeply about things people care about with compelling personalities who have humor and are entertaining as well as being informative and are good company, over time, it's not going to work. And I had lots and lots of years of experience of doing this and setting up talkback stations all around the world. And I didn't think Britain was that different a place. Human beings are still human beings.
On FM, DAB, and online, London's biggest conversation. This is LBC 97.3.
And so from that first conversation, it became looking at every aspect of, and at the time it was LBC, looking at every piece of the radio station, what works, what doesn't, try to find the best people and then give them the runway and give them the tools, give them the skills. And some of those friendships have turned into lifelong friendships with the people that I had the opportunity to work with, and I feel very blessed.
But as I was coming in this morning, there he was, MDR, Managing Director of Radio, collecting the old milk bottles, as in days of yore. Collecting the milk in that disgusting dressing gown. And that air of shabby gentility that characterises the BBC senior executive. And I said, hello, sir. Tipping the cap to him smartly. Hello, sir. How are you today? And he said, hello, mate. How are you?
The first time I heard Terry Wogan on the air, I was just knocked out. And then I saw research on Terry. One of the respondents to the research had said, when we book our holidays, we book our holidays at the same time as Terry Wogan takes off because we don't want to be in England when Terry's not on the radio. That's the Mount Everest of research. I would like to see that about every host I work with, that's how much of your day this human being, this personality connects. You feel like you could go over to their house and have a beer with them. And that's the essence of personality radio. It's very intimate and it's very detailed. So I think that in Great Britain, culturally, there was some reserve and some conservative personality, not political, but just personal, of people being, they were holding back. I was surprised at how good it was, and I was surprised at how bad it was. When it was good, it was so good. And when it was bad, it was truly, truly awful. And what happened in Britain is that as each host began to see that the more personal you would go, if you would do a little bit of authentic self-revelation, it would reap huge rewards. Because the personal is universal. If you feel it, other people feel it. It's the private that's boring. I, me, me, me. But the minute you make it you, then it works.
Your station for Yorkshire. Yorkshire.
BBC Radio Leeds.
There's a fantastic presenter called Liz Green. She's up at BBC Radio Leeds. Liz had been a journalist for 20 years, and people said, oh no, Liz will never take to these ideas because they're so American and personality. She's a journalist. Well, Liz tried it, and, you know, lo and behold, she was on across five different radio stations up in the north because the personal is universal. She could interview politicians and get the bad guys with the best of them, but she also likes to shop for shoes, you know? She's a girl. So she let all the parts of her personality out, and it really worked for her.
Afternoon from the Big Yorkshire Phone-In, it's Liz with you, and we're talking about your mental health this hour, and if you've been struggling with anxiety or stress or depression, it's whether or not that's affected how you're working, and you've had the courage, and I do think it takes courage, to tell your employer.
I made a decision.
A lot of employers probably might not want to hear it.
30 years ago. That if anybody wanted to learn the powerful radio methods that are in Beyond Powerful Radio and very available, I mean, the book is an audiobook on Audible and it's free. You know, if you're on Audible, you get a free book every month, so you can download the whole thing for free. So that isn't even a barrier. But I decided that it's like writing a cookbook and then inviting the chef to come into your kitchen and help you. So I put everything I knew in the book, everything I knew that worked, and then continuously updated it as new ideas became successful or as the media landscape changed. The first book came out in 1996, and it was heavily supported by M Street Publications. And the second book was The Workbook, which was about air checking, developing talent through listening to their previous work. And then the third book was actually put out by Elsevier, which was based in Oxford and also in Holland. And the fourth book is Beyond Powerful Radio, which is now Taylor and Francis Rutledge, also Oxford-based publication. And then I decided I would go anywhere in the world if people wanted to learn these methods. So I'll never forget, one time I was in Mexico, and I was going to work at a little radio station, and the road had been flooded out in a big, heavy rainstorm. And we went up a mountain road on a burro. Do you know what a burro is? It's a half donkey, half horse, and not too terribly comfortable in 100-degree heat in the blazing sun on animals, pack animals, up a mountain to get to a radio station that was basically a coat hanger and a shack at the top of a hill where they were broadcasting local radio. And when we arrived, I saw my book in tatters next to the microphone and Spanish writing all over it, and I wept. Because in the middle of nowhere, that you have to get on an animal to get there, in the blazing sun in a foreign language, these ideas were working to help people communicate to their local audiences what they needed to know. And it filled my heart with joy. And that was as satisfying to me as standing up in front of the European Broadcasting Union and talking about these methods, or speaking at the National Association of Broadcasters, or Radio Days in Europe, or Next Radio in London. And I don't care if you're broadcasting to 1 or 1 million. You know, when Terry Wogan was asked how many people are listening to you, he would say one.
And I've never doubted my ability to speak into a microphone. And I've always been able to do it. Television took an awful lot longer.
Back in the days of rotary phones, when you had to physically dial a phone and it would go around and come back. But I can remember one time I was actually home and I was trying to make a phone call and I realized I was dialing zero to try to get an outside line. And I was not in a hotel, and I had been in hotels so much that I was trying to make a phone call, and I was dialing out, and I realized, no, too much time on the road. What I found was that part of what keeps this work alive and what keeps this work interesting is that when you walk into a radio station in a new country where you haven't been and you don't know the customs, the culture, and you're working out of language, it's an opportunity to learn and an opportunity to experience life in a different way that might not be comfortable, but it will be rich, a rich experience. You're meeting the creative community. You're meeting the mayor. You're meeting the artists, the poet laureates are walking in. You're meeting musicians. You're meeting the most interesting people in a culture because they're being interviewed by the people you're working with. Then my cousin, who also works as a consultant, she is in the art world, Amy suggested, if you're still working past 3 o'clock in the afternoon, make them take you someplace interesting. So you ask people, take me where you take people when they come to visit. And so in Norway, I've gotten to see the end of the world, you know, the rocks at the very edge of the world, or, you know, in Finland, up, you know, to the ice hotel, or, you know, you just see places and people and things you would never see if you were just there working. And if you're under fluorescent lights in meeting rooms and offices, you're never going to see the place. But if you're in the car with a client who runs a radio station or an on-air personality who does a breakfast show and they take you to their favorite place that means something to them and they tell you the story behind it, it makes the experience rich and wonderful. And that makes the sitting on airplanes and the interminable moments of your life that get eked away in airports, it makes it worth it.
We thank you for flying with us today. We truly appreciate your business and look forward to serving you on a future flight.
You know how they tell you on the airplane, always get up and walk around on the plane, especially on these long flights. Well, I fly every week because that's part of my job. As I said, I will fly anywhere to work with anyone who would like to learn these methods. I'm happy to do that. And after a particularly long flight, I got off the plane. I was okay. But I'd had this pain in my leg. I thought I'd pulled a muscle. You know, when you're carrying luggage and, you know, running around airports, you know, you sometimes get banged up a little. So I didn't think too much about it. 2 or 3 days later, I was a little bit short of breath. It was hard to, like, get that deep breath. And I was sitting in a meeting with a client, and he looked at me and he said, Valerie, are you okay? And I said, well, you know, I think I might be coming down with something, you know, maybe a cold or a, I don't know. And he said, you don't look so good. And I said, yeah, you know, I'm having trouble getting a deep breath and, you know, I've had this pain in my leg, but I'm fine. And he said, I don't think you are. I think we should go get you checked out. I think we should go to casualty, go to the emergency room. Why don't we call your doctor in New York? And if your doctor in New York says go to the hospital, we're going to the hospital. So I called my doctor and my doctor said, nope, you need to get checked out immediately. And it turned out to be deep vein thrombosis, a blood clot in my leg, which was also in the lungs. And it could be potentially deadly. And it was a wake-up call. And you feel very humbled when things go wrong with your body, and you feel very vulnerable. But mostly, every cliche is true. You appreciate life in a completely different way. You start making a list. Who's important? Who are the people I love that I want to spend time around? What work do I want to do right now that makes me feel purposeful, where I can use what I have to offer to make the world better and make a contribution? What makes you happy? These are things that you suddenly look at in a very different way, because time feels short. And I feel so grateful for the opportunities I've had, but I feel like there's so much left to do. And what's exciting to me now is working in the podcast space. I've consulted on 4 television documentaries that have been films for POV in America and also American Public Television. And we've done films on global water sustainability. We've done films on Daisy Bates, the woman who literally broke the race barrier in the United States by choosing the Little Rock 9 kids who were the first to integrate schools in 1959. I've worked on a lot of films that were important to me and allowed that journalism storytelling part of me to blossom, as well as training broadcasters and working coaching talent. So I realized there were so many more things I want to do, and there's so many songs left unsung that I'm hoping to have a long and healthy life. My goals are to try and lose 10 pounds and to try to exercise more and to always walk around on the airplane. And if I just leave you with one thing from this interview, walk around on the plane next time you're on an airplane. I don't care what the flight attendants say. Do not stay, you know, strapped in like a good soldier. Get up and walk. Get up and move. Radio looks good, and it's not radio. It's people in life and audio. You know, do you really care if it comes through the fillings in your teeth, if it's great content? You know, tell the truth, make it matter, never be boring. Inform, entertain, inspire, persuade, connect. If you're alone in a room, alone in a car, and you can push a button and not be alone, to be connected to community, to laugh, to have joy, humor, learn what's going on, find out what you need to know to get through your day, feel less isolated in a very isolated world. These are things that are never going to go away. I take joy, and I really attribute this to my mom, who was a very joyful person. I take joy in very small things. When I hear something wonderful on the radio, especially if it's a client that I have helped catalyze, and they really get it, to me, it is thrilling and exciting, and it gives me great happiness and joy. I can remember when I was working in the Philippines, and they flew me from Manila to Davao, and it was at sunset, and the entire sky turned red, and the sun was this golden ball that suddenly dropped beneath the horizon, and then the red, blood-red sky turned black, and a million stars came out, and I saw the world in a new way, and it brought me such joy. And I realized if I didn't have this job, radio, and this career, I would have never seen that marvel from the sky. And it just filled me. When I think about people who have moved me, changed my life, given me insight, when I think about Professor Carl Faber, who wrote a book called On Listening that changed my life, he talked about listening was the greatest gift you could ever give to another human being. To be free to be all that you are, you know, laugh, cry, weep, pound the floor, to not worry about judgment, to be free from the tyranny of the eyes of others, and to just be free with another person. And that was the gift of listening. To me, Carl will live forever because he shared those ideas with me. And they gave me my life, they gave me my job in radio, and they gave me my belief in communication in human beings, and that you could really change people through things they heard on the air. And I sometimes think if you give people one technique or one idea that helps them in their life, that's a life that's well lived. And I think that what's really important at the end of the day is to love people, because radio stations don't love you back. You can love radio, but it doesn't love you back. So love people and love humans. Invest in humans, but love well, because that's what a good life is.